From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the editor of the Sacramento Press joins us for our weekly roundup of top local stories. Also, Hollywood stuntman and Foothills resident Gary Davis and rock band Walking Spanish, a headliner at this weekend's Shannapalooza Music Festival. But first, perhaps you've seen the artist's impressions of the planned new arena for downtown Sacramento. They look nice, but then so did the artist's impressions of previous planned arenas that didn't get built. What, if anything, is different this time? Where will the money come from? And what about getting to and from the arena? There's little room for new parking, so where would cars go? Not to mention the big transit center currently planned for the same site as the arena. Joining us to talk about these questions are two Sacramento Bee reporters who are covering the arena story. They're Ryan Lillis, who covers City Hall, and Tony Bishak, who covers transportation. Ryan, Tony, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Well, Ryan, let's start with you. What was the political reaction to the plan that was released last week? In particular, the fact that there was no financing specified in the plan. David Taylor, the developer, had been given 100 days to come up with this report.
So far, I think the reaction has been positive. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that people say we're further along now than we have been in the past. And that's kind of a direct reference to 2006 when local officials tried to get measures Q and R passed, sales tax measures that would have paid for a new arena in downtown Rail Yard. And there's a sense now that we have a clearer idea of what we're getting here. We have a price tag. We have drawings. We have number of seats. We have a lot more details on the arena than we had in 2006, and it's almost $200 million less than what the proposed arena would have been back in 2006. So there's a lot more optimism. In terms of the financing, that's going to be the key element that will be investigated over the next 100 days or so. The mayor is expected, Mayor Kevin Johnson is expected to invite regional elected and business and labor leaders to join a regional arena commission. He'll probably make those invitations and appointments this week, perhaps as early as Thursday. And their number one charge will be coming up with the public contribution element to all of this. There are still some things to be determined on the private end, such as what the contribution from the Maloof family, the owners of the Sacramento Kings, what their contribution to the project will be, as well as if there's going to be a third-party arena operator involved here, such as an AEG, a company that would put up perhaps some upfront money to the construction costs. So once those elements are determined, then we'll know exactly what the public contribution will have to be.
Why is the currently planned arena so much cheaper than the arena that was planned in 2006? It's in more or less the same downtown location. What's different?
That's a good question. I don't know if we knew enough details about the 2006 plan. We knew that it was $541 million, and this is $387 million. I think there was a sense right from the beginning with this Icon Taylor group that that $541 million figure was way too high. In fact, when the council asked Icon Venue Group and David Taylor to work on this arena feasibility study, Tim Romani, who is the president of Icon, famously told the city council, if you want to spend $600 million, I can build you two arenas for that. So I think it's just maybe a fresh set of eyes. Beyond that, I'm not sure what's different about the specifics with the project.
We're talking about the planned new arena for downtown Sacramento, trying to answer some early questions. Ryan Lillis is a Sacramento Bee reporter, as is Tony Bishak, who covers, among other things, transportation. Tony, when I look at the map of where this arena would be, it seems to be more or less in the same spot as this planned transit center that's sometimes called the Intermodal Center. Is that right?
It's exactly the same spot. It's about 6 to 10 acres right behind right north of the downtown depot. The intention has been for years to build what they call an intermodal, which is a transit center that could facilitate, buses, different types of trains. Anyway, that's supposed to be built right there, and that's the exact spot the arena guys decided to locate an arena.
Was this an oversight?
No, not at all. I mean, that That spot has been the city owns a handful of acres there just north of the depot. Much of the rest of the rail yard land is in private ownership. So when there's discussion of an arena, they always talk about sticking it on the city-owned land because it'd be cheaper. The city already owns the land. There was an arena proposal last year that attempted to merge the two buildings, put the transit center and the arena basically in the same facility, and that was an extremely tight fit. But the arena alone on this site is a tight fit. I think that the people that were putting the Icon Taylor Group was just trying to see at this point whether an arena the size they want to build or the size they think it should be can fit on the site. They say it does very tightly. I talked to David Taylor after they made their presentation last Thursday, and he said they're aware, yes, that the intermodal is planned for that site. It is not an oversight. They now, in the next 100 days of exploring the financial feasibility or how to finance an arena, they also, he said, it's very important for them to explore how do you fit an intermodal on that same site. And I think there's real doubts that the two facilities can fit in the same site.
So, but right now, as far as David Taylor is concerned, or at least as far as he's saying in public, they're looking for a way to squeeze both facilities into the same parcel.
They're going to look for a way to squeeze the two. But he expressed some doubts about that. And I think just look at the site and how large that arena is and how large the intermodal was going to be. And I think anybody would have doubts. I don't see how the two actually fit. And David Taylor said maybe they would have to go to Inland, the Inland American, the owner of the most of the rail yard, and ask to see if they can do some deal to buy some land or get some land, extra land, for an intermodal.
Now, when I look at a map of the proposed development, you've got the new railroad tracks right just north of the arena. You've got Interstate 5 just to the west. You've got extended 5th and 6th Streets just to the east, and you got the current Amtrak station and other existing developments and roads just to the south. So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of room, even if you did buy some more land, to add anything else.
That's a serious question. That plan last year that had merged the two buildings had designed it so that they would share concourses, so that the route that you would take to get into the arena would be the same route that you take to get to your trains. But David Taylor was saying, as looking into this, they're thinking that you can't merge the federal transportation financing too tightly with arena financing. So it may be harder than they thought to get a facility that could house the two buildings. Now, I mean, this sort of thing has been done in other cities where you build an arena and a transit facility together, and you know how great that would work for a lot of people, especially so they don't have to take their car, especially in a site like this that is somewhat locked in and it's hard to get to in cars, or it'll be hard to get close to in cars. You really need, for an urban arena, to have a real good transit system associated with it. So even though it seems hard to see how you can fit the two together, it's going to be David Taylor described it as a great opportunity too.
Tony Bijak of the Sacramento Bee. Ryan Lillis, as we already talked about, the report that came out, the feasibility study, I guess, that came out last week, did not include specifics about where the money to pay for this arena would come from. Is it just a coincidence that they're not talking about that yet, just as the city council is also talking about making further big cuts to the city budget, including probably laying off police officers? Because the public funding has always been the most controversial part of all this.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence. There were ideas presented on what the public contribution could be, but they were taken out of the report. You could speculate that the smart play here is to let the politicians be the ones who present those ideas for the public contribution. Probably the worst thing you could do is have a development team come in and say, we think the public should be taxed so-and-so, or we think there should be a hotel or rental car tax or this, without allowing elected leaders to weigh in on it first. It would certainly be a hard play to convince people here to swallow any kind of public contribution right now, like you said, as the city is dealing with the very strong possibility of laying off 80 police officers and browning out fire engines. So I think there was a sense that let's let this regional commission weigh in on it first over the next 100 days, and let the ideas come out of the city halls and the board of supervisors around the region.
You said that Mayor Kevin Johnson is going to convene this regional commission, elected officials from throughout the 4-county or even maybe even the 6-county region in and around Sacramento. But realistically, what kind of contributions of public money can be expected from cities and counties outside of Sacramento? Because their personal direct benefits from the arena would be a lot less than would be accrued by the city of Sacramento.
Well, I'm not sure anybody's going to come up with a proposal to implement some kind of regional sales tax. I think what's probably more likely is things like a ticket surcharge, user fee, or these hotel and rental car taxes, because I think you're right that convincing, you know, Loomis or Lincoln or, you know, South Lake Tahoe or Yuba City to come up with some kind of out-of-pocket contribution towards something might be difficult politically for those cities to accept. But there is definitely a sense that there's going to have to be definitely some kind of regional contribution, or at least a weigh-in from the region. And it is 6 counties. It's 22 cities and 6 counties. You'll probably see some representation from the capital on this commission. So there's a sense here anyways that it can't be just City Hall going it alone on this.
Tony Bishak, we talked earlier about where the transit center would fit if the arena goes where it looks like it might go, assuming money appears. But that connects in with the whole issue of how people would get to and from the arena, because there's very little room for parking where they're talking right now about putting the arena, which would mean there'd be all the more demand, presumably, for transit like light rail and so on, which means that there would be more interest in having the transit right next to the arena.
Light rail has an expansion plan. You know, they have a light rail line that goes to the downtown depot now. And they're starting to build a spur line up into the Richards Boulevard area. That ultimately would go out through Natomas to the airport. And that line is planned to be directed through the rail yard in a way that would, you know, merge really well with an arena, probably anywhere in the you put an arena in the rail yard. It's going to be a line to connect with light rail. We've seen in other cities that are actually more into transit than we are here, that it's really not more than 20% of people who use transit to go to the arena. But that is a substantial number. I think that would be a substantial number here in Sacramento. And so I think, you know, talking with RT and talking with the developers in the city, everybody intends for this arena to be set up so light rail works very well with it. I was talking to the head of RT last week about it, and he's already got plans for a little spur line next to the arena where they could park some trains and have them ready to go so that when an event is done, they could get, what is it? He said, I think 6,000 people within like a 25-minute period away from that, out from that area down to Meadowview, Folsom, up to North Sac on trains.
Sure. But there are a lot of people who won't use light rail, and maybe it's not even an option for them because the light rail doesn't go anywhere near where they live. So some kind of accommodation for cars is needed. Where would people park?
Well, Ryan can help me with this, but the plan is there are a lot of parking garages, city-owned parking garages, within a quarter, half mile of downtown. The arena site, there's Old Sac and a few others, and I think the number is something like 6,000 or more. Or is it even 8,000 spots available at those parking garages? They're used for workers during the daytime, but when game night, they're largely empty. And so the idea is, with an urban arena, you get people to park in these garages a few blocks from the arena and walk to it. People will be willing to do that, they say, if the walk from the parking spot to the arena has some vitality to it. At this point, that's not really the case here, but that could happen.
And Ryan, you wrote about this in your City Beat blog. What did people say in response?
On the blog, people were not sure. I mean, it's not sure that would be something that would fly. It's about 8,200 parking spaces within four blocks. And, you know, Tim Romani told the council last week that he walked around at night around that area and that nearly all of those parking spaces were empty in the evenings when most of the events would be taking place at the arena. But you're talking about a car culture and asking people to change a big part of their lives and kind of embracing this urban experience in taking light rail and parking four blocks away and walking to an arena past these bars and restaurants, something you see at the baseball park down in San Francisco and in most other NBA cities, this urban experience. So it'll be very interesting to see whether that's something that Sacramentans are willing to embrace.
And Ryan, do we actually have a date when David Taylor and Icon are supposed to report back once again with more details about money?
Well, this regional commission will be working sometime into September, so somewhere around Labor Day or thereafter, I think, is the next time we will hear in great detail anyway what the financing plan looks like.
I see. Well, thank you both so much, Ryan Lillis and Tony Bishak. They're both reporters with the Sacramento Bee, and their beat includes the story about the proposed new arena in downtown Sacramento. Ryan, Tony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And by the way, Mayor Kevin Johnson is having a press conference today. One of our reporters, James Morrison, will be covering it, and you'll hear his story during All Things Considered this afternoon. It's possible that the mayor will be talking about the financing for this proposed new arena. You are listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll catch up on some other local stories in the news with the editor of the Sacramento Press. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation today, what it takes to turn around big institutions. One person who succeeded in turning around a university says, do things quickly and worry about corrections later. Also, The End of Anger. It's a new book about race and rage. Talk of the Nation starts at 11, right after Insight. Each Tuesday, we catch up on stories in local news and culture with the editor of the online newspaper, The Sacramento Press, David Watts Barton. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, our first topic that we're going to talk about is the topic I talked about earlier with Ryan and Tony at the Sacramento Bee, the proposed new arena. Anything you'd like to add on that?
Well, they covered it pretty well. I have to admit I was a little disappointed when it came out. I thought they were going to address the financing more carefully, because that does seem to be the number one issue. And I thought it was interesting also that parking came up, because that's an issue that people don't talk about. And in the last comment there, he was saying about changing the car culture in Sacramento is going to be a very interesting challenge.
Yeah, you know, someone posted a message on Capital Public Radio's Facebook wall in reaction to the topic we talked about earlier. And Will wrote, regarding planning a new arena in conjunction with a new public transit station, are they considering other models such as Madison Square Garden in New York City and its relation to Penn Station? Mm-hmm. Penn Station is below the arena. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's absolutely right. Of course, there's a big difference between New York with its enormous public transportation infrastructure and Sacramento with a couple of light rail lines.
And again, that comes down to money. That's going to cost a lot of money. I mean, I always think about when they first talked about the proposal of putting the two together, the first thing I thought of was Madison Square Garden, because it's so obvious. I mean, that's Penn Station's right there, right?
Yeah.
How they're going to put that together, and again, it comes back to the financing. That was my disappointment in the report, because we've seen a lot of proposals. We've seen a lot of interesting proposals about how this can be put together. But when I first read it, and it was like, okay, it's going to be this many more seats and this many more luxury boxes and things like that. And it's like, those aren't the issues. The issues are, how are we going to pay for it and where are we going to put it?
I don't know if you saw the photograph on the front page of the Sacramento Bee when the arena proposal was released. But one thing that really stood out in that was there was just this picture of a whole sea of people, and they're all guys. I guess women don't have much of a role to play in the arena discussion.
Yeah, well,
behind the scenes, perhaps.
There are a number of situations where that's the case, I suppose. But,
yeah.
Well, you know, as far as the Kings and things like that, it probably is more of a guy thing.
Yeah.
But again, I just think it's going to be going down, and our office is at the train station. So I walk past this parcel every day going to work. And you look at it, and it's like, yeah, it's not very big. It's a pretty small area. I mean, the rail yards itself is very big, but as Tony or Ryan pointed out, most of it's been private hands, and is earmarked for completely different things.
Yes.
And also, I'm not sure what I'd like to hear more about the intermodal hub, because right now, I mean, the light rail does go right to the train station. It's right next to the tracks, and the tracks are virtually right next to each other. So that's already established. I'm wondering what more is going to be in the intermodal hub that everybody's talking about. They're also, I don't think they mentioned, there's also a lot of money riding on, I think it's $21 million from the federal government to support this construction of the intermodal hub, which could go away if the arena is too close, but then they could repurpose it, and it's all incredibly complicated.
David Watts Barton is editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. Regarding the city budget, I understand they're going to be voting tonight on federal funding. You mentioned federal funds with regard to the intermodal transit center, but there's also federal funding for fire.
Yeah, there's some federal funding, and I'm sorry, I don't know what the exact figure is, but there's some federal funding to help avoid the brownouts. There's some public money available. I can't imagine anybody on the city council is going to vote against it. They're actually the big battle is going to come out next week, which is going to be when they start voting on these cuts. And as I think Rob Fong said to one of our reporters from the city council, said, this is a zero-sum game. Any money that we take from one area is going to be taken from another. And it's, you know, it's a lot of it is labor negotiations. A lot of it is, there's a lot of brinksmanship going on. The fact of the matter is that they're talking about a number of cuts in the fire department, but they're talking about cutting positions that are not filled. So as best that we can figure out, none of the quote unquote layoffs from the fire department are actually going to be layoffs of people. They'll just be closing positions that they would like to fill.
Now, Sacramento County also is in budget hearing mode, as are all local governments in California, I guess. And their plan released last week includes tens of millions of dollars in cuts.
Yeah, they have a $90 million shortfall. People forget, you know, the county's sort of invisible. The city tends to get most of the attention in the media. The county is actually a much, much bigger government, covers a lot more people, obviously. And they have a much bigger budget deficit. The city's $39 million. The county's is about $90 million. And they've already cut a lot. So, you know, we're into uncharted territory in terms of the cuts on this. And a lot of the what the county does that the city doesn't do, and people also don't realize this, most of what the city does is, especially now, public safety, police, fire, and they're also going to be talking about cutting some stuff in the transportation department and financing, but that's a few positions here or there, or, you know, $500,000, $600,000 there, which in the grand scheme of things, it matters, but it's still relatively small compared to what they put together. The county does community services, social services, welfare, aid to families, kids programs, all these sorts of things. And they've already cut an awful lot of that, and they're going to have to cut more.
Getting back to re-envisioning dead spaces, Capitol Mall, there's a design competition there. Whose design competition? Is this an official thing?
Yeah, this is something that they voted for about 5 years ago. They decided that they want to put this up for competition, and it's a design competition. It's going to be international. Right now, I guess it hasn't gone international. It's more open to local people, and I guess people like Ron Vlachos and some of the well-known local architects have weighed in. We had a story on the site, which was really interesting, because what happened is that people started weighing in, as they do in the conversation, and one of those people was Bill Berg, who has been on this show before.
Local historian.
A local historian. and knows everything about downtown, particularly downtown Central City Sacramento. And he was talking about the history of Capitol Mall and how they move people around. And, you know, that used to be a very ethnically diverse area with a lot of different things going on. And then they declared it blighted and came in and turned it into the sort of grand boulevard that we have now that nobody really walks down.
Yeah, it's for people who are not familiar, we're talking about the part of Capitol Avenue that's west of the state capitol building leading up to Tower Bridge. And it looks grand mm-hmm. from a distance because it's very broad, but it's a very dead space in the middle. It's got the huge grass median with nothing on it, not even trees, if I remember correctly.
It does. There's nothing out there and there's no public art. I mean, it's quite impressive. And if you come in over the Capitol, over the Tower Bridge, it's a great entrance. And that's the old entrance to Sacramento before you used to just sort of get shoveled over on the Pioneer Bridge on I-80. But there is that, you know, some people are saying that that's really not, with all the other issues that we have to deal with right now, that's not real high priority. One thing that didn't come up in the discussion of the rail yards is that there was a fear that the commission in San Francisco that was deciding where to put the new county courthouse was going to put it on Capitol Mall. In that space that used to be the Sacramento Union and that was supposed to be the Twin Towers that John Sacco was doing, right? And then that fell through. Now the courthouse is also going to be in the rail yards. That's going to be between 5th and 6th Street, just north of the Federal Building, which is now a parking lot and where the rail tracks are now. But they're going to be moved north. So, and that means, obviously, I think that the light rail line might have to be moved, although it could be on the other side of the street. I mean, it's interesting if anybody's really interested to go down there and go to I and 5th Street, go to the train station and look around, because it's an interesting space to look at. It's very oddly shaped, and there are a lot of competing interests there. And that's the other thing, is that they did decide that the courthouse is going to go there, which is what everybody local wanted to happen. But that adds a whole bunch of, that's going to be a huge parking issue too.
You bet.
And then so that leaves Capitol Mall, and it leaves Capitol Mall spoiled in that way, but it's still, you know, there's House, the restaurant, and that's about it, right? And a lot of buildings that people go to, state workers go to during the day and then leave.
8 to 5 Monday to Friday type of things.
Oh, for an eye, we shouldn't leave them out either.
Absolutely. David Watts Barton, Editor-in-Chief of the Sacramento Press. We'll have to wrap it up there. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Hollywood stuntman and Foothills resident Gary Davis. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A stuntman in some of the most famous action films of the last few decades lives in the Sierra Foothills. Gary Davis of Auburn started making films in the early 70s as a stuntman and stunt coordinator. His resume includes Terminator 2, Speed, and Independence Day. Gary Davis also worked on The Green Hornet with Seth Rogen that came out earlier this year. And Hollywood is in the family business. His wife has acted and his daughter is an actress and does stunt work too. Gary's in our studio. Gary Davis, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
How did you get started doing stunt?
In the early 70s, a man named Evel Knievel and I were rivals, and so they needed someone in the picture business that could do that.
You were his rival?
I was for a few years.
Yeah. How did that turn out?
It was good for me for a while. I set a world record beating his 19-car world record. I set a world record jumping 21, and then we would yell at each other on My World of Sports off and on, and eventually, when I got in the picture business, he insisted that I do all his writing. So ever since 76, I've done all his writing. He hasn't done any.
And what did that mean that you were his rival? Was that an actual rivalry, or was it sort of a more of a friendly business relationship that pretended to be a rivalry?
No, we didn't like each other much.
Really?
In fact, I had a partner in 1971 and 2 named Rex Blackwell, and we used to cross. We would come at each other and cross over the cars when we jumped. And when we set the world record at Ontario Motor Speedway, we got a telegram to the Speedway asking if Mickey and Minnie Mouse had made their jump yet.
Oh, my goodness. Now, you said that when you got into films, Evel Knievel wanted you to do his stunt work?
Yeah, but
why didn't he do it?
Well, when I first got in the picture business, the very first show I did, Sam Elliott was playing Evel Knievel for a television pilot for CBS. And so they brought me in to double Sam. And Evel found out about it and actually took all his equipment away from the company. So we had to quickly make my stuff look like his stuff. And so we were still rivals then and not very friendly. And then when he crashed over 13 buses in Wembley Stadium in London, he, out of the blue, called me and had me come over and finish his tour for him through Europe. And from that point on, I got him back in shape. And then he, his first movie as an actor was called Viva Knievel. And as an actor, we wouldn't allow him to ride, so I did all the riding.
My guest is Hollywood stuntman Gary Davis. He lives in Auburn. How do you learn how to be a stuntman? Is there a school for stunt people?
Truth is, there are some schools around, but they aren't taken very serious. So most of us that come into the picture business come in with some sort of expertise. I mean, mine obviously at the time was motorcycles. And most everybody that's a successful stunt person has some sort of a national or world title in whatever sport they excel in.
Yes. Have you ever been really hurt doing stunt in a film to the extent that it made you question why you were doing it?
Yes. a movie called Smoking the Bandit 2. Our director, Hal Needham, wanted a world record car jump set. And so they brought me in to drive a cop car up and over a ramp. And 165 feet later, when I landed, it broke my back. And so I couldn't feel my legs at first, and so that certainly made me question a lot of things. And my daughter had just been born at that time. So from that point on, I really haven't done any really big jumps. I've coordinated a lot, but I don't do them anymore.
Now, you've worked in many, many films over the years, including some very well-known films, maybe among the most notable, Terminator 2. You were the stunt coordinator on that.
Is that correct? I was a stunt coordinator and the second unit director.
I see. So did you actually do stunts in the film too?
I did a little bit of the car driving and spun some cars out and stuff. But normally when I'm directing, I'm insured and they won't allow me to do anything because the film would go down and my whole unit would go down if I get hurt.
Yes. What's your favorite film that you've worked on?
Oh, gosh. Small films that you wouldn't have heard about, like Eagle Rock Rebels Ride Again, was only because, I mean, we were in Lake Havasu and riding motorcycles and jet skis and stuff every single day and playing on the river. So those are fun. But,
yeah.
But you know, certainly Terminator 2 was a big credit for me. And we just finished Spider-Man last week, actually. And
the fourth film.
Yeah, it would be, if you were counting, it would be Spider-Man 4, but it's Spider-Man 1 all over again because this is a new kid and he gets bit by a spider and the whole story starts again.
And what are you doing on the Spider-Man film?
The actual truth is I'm just a stunt guy on it. The Armstrongs, which are friendly rivals of mine, we always compete for the second unit director slot or the coordinator slot. The two brothers, Vic and Andy, were the second unit director and the stunt coordinator, and they brought me in just to do a bunch of the stunt work. And on this movie, we're really flying Spider-Man around. There's no CG. You know, we built a special rig that I would drive through New York City, and he would swing behind me, go from building to building, and it's all done for real.
It's kind of ironic that they're going old school with the effects in this film today. Why did they make that decision? Because it's a lot safer, presumably, to do it with computer-generated effects.
It's absolutely more safe. But those of us that are old school enjoy seeing the stunts for real. I mean, there's movies out like Fast Five right now, and you see the car rollovers and stuff are all fictitious things made up in the computer. And that certainly doesn't excite me. It plays to the kids of today that are playing video games and stuff like that and accept that kind of look. But, you know, we convince somebody that it's good to see it old school.
My guest is Hollywood stuntman, stunt coordinator, director Gary Davis. Can you tell us about any of the stunts you did in the upcoming Spider-Man film?
There aren't any really big stunts. Like it's not a big action movie that way. So most everything we did was circled around Spider-Man flying. And we would have 30 to 60 cars that were full of stunt people that would drive down the road just because he would swing And if we got him out of control, or if we happened to be swinging over in front of a higher profile vehicle, an SUV or a truck or something, we had stunt people in all the vehicles so they could get out of the way and not splat him like a bug on a windshield.
So did you actually have to put the Spider-Man costume on?
No, I never did. Excuse me. We had three stunt doubles for him. One specializes in parkour, which is free running, if you know that sport at all.
Yeah, it's this crazy thing about jumping up over obstacles in cities and so on.
Correct. Fabulous.
It's like Spider-Man, basically.
Like Spider-Man, exactly. So one of them was a parkour specialist. One was a skateboard specialist. And then we had an Asian guy from Korea, actually, who was our best flyer on the wires. So all three of them could fly on the wires, but he was our preference on the wires.
I was looking you up on imdb.com, the film credits website, and I noticed that your daughter she's an actress and does stunt, and she worked on Spider-Man too.
Yeah, she's primarily an actress, but we brought her in as one of the car drivers so she could be in New York City with me and stuff, and she does a good job. She's a good girl.
But your wife has some stunt credits too.
Well, that's my daughter's mother, who's currently not my wife, actually.
Right. Okay.
My wife, Trina's at home taking care of the yard right now.
So I guess your own experiences with doing stunt didn't put your daughter off, didn't make her think, oh, my God, that's too hard a life.
No, but I never thought she was going to actually do stunt work. I mean, she studied to be an actress and is a good actress, but jobs come easier to her as a stunt person because she can drop daddy's name now and then and stuff and get in on jobs where there's a big call of stunt people.
Why do you live in Auburn? I mean, most of your work must be in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. It is in Los Angeles or somewhere in the world other than Auburn. I grew up in Loomis. So I left here in 1969 after graduating from Del Oro High School and went to Arizona to go to college and then fell into the picture business. And I kept promising myself that I would someday come back to this area. And it's 10 years ago I finally did.
Yeah. But on your credits is at least one locally made film, Her Minor Thing.
I did do Her Minor Thing here, yeah. And I've done a few, actually. We did Wisdom here, and we did XXX here. We did...
XXX, wasn't that at the Forest Hill Bridge?
Yeah, we ran the Corvette off the Forest Hill Bridge. And then
you were involved in that?
Just helped rig it.
I see. Yeah. You know, I've looked over that bridge and tried to imagine what it must be like to do something there, and it's almost unimaginable. Could you imagine jumping off the edge of something like that?
Well, certainly skydiving isn't something that I do. So, but to all the base jumpers and bungee guys and stuff, and we've had a lot of them go off that bridge in live shows and stuff, that they all love it. Yeah.
And when does the Spider-Man film come out, do you know?
Probably a year from right about now.
I see.
I mean, we just wrapped it, and it'll be easily 6 months in post.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. Gary Davis, Hollywood stuntman and Auburn resident. Gary Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Sacramento rock band Walking Spanish. They're playing a music festival this weekend. It's Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The wet winter and spring means more fuel for the coming fire season. That story and more on Capital Public Radio News on All Things Considered. It starts at 4. The Shannapalooza Music Festival happens this Saturday. It's a riverfront thing out in Garden Highway. And one of the bands playing is Walking Spanish, a rock group from Sacramento that's expanding its musical horizon. The band's second album, called Wishbones, came out a couple of months ago, and it had a more polished and varied sound than the first record that came out in 2007. Walking Spanish joined us on Inside in March and played live in our studio, and I asked band leader Alex Nelson why it took the second album 4 years.
Well, there was a small period of time that was like spent writing songs, and then we played a whole bunch of shows, and then basically we were ready to make a record probably in 2008 when we got the new band arrangement with the five of us here, and then after that it was just a matter of trying to raise the money.
Which you did using Kickstarter.com.
Yes, yeah.
And you raised $10,000.
Yes, we did, and that was... The funny thing is that we didn't start the Kickstarter thing until we were halfway done with the record, and that was when we ran out of the money we saved up over the past, you know, couple of years, because that money went pretty fast when you're really getting into a, you know, a real studio and usually utilizing the time and just like really getting into making the record instead of just trying to make a glorified demo, you know.
And the video you made for the Kickstarter page was hilarious. You were looking through this couch and you found a $5 bill, and that got you a few seconds in the recording studio.
It did, and you know what? Proportionally, that's not far off from being accurate.
Yeah. My guests are the band Walking Spanish. Their new record is out, their second album. It's called Wishbones. And they're going to play one of the songs from that in our studio. Alex, what song are we going to hear?
This song is called Jackson Is Long Gone.
Okay.
Set me.
That was great. One of the songs from the new album Wishbones by Walking Spanish, playing in our studio. Alex Nelson, the character in that song, Jackson, his name is spelled a little differently, J-A-C-K-S-I-N. Why did you spell him that way?
Well, it all came from how we just write our set lists. We kind of misspell every song on the set list every time for some reason, just to make something humorous. And that one came about one time, and I thought it looked neat.
It does.
And it set it apart, and also, you know, people wouldn't mistake it for, you know, the other Jackson, Johnny Cash's Jackson.
Well, it makes him seem a little more evil, doesn't it?
I guess so, and I guess that's what it's all about, right? It's an image thing for, I guess, it sets the tone.
This is a big band now. There's five of you. Last time you were here a few years ago, there were just three members of the band. How come the band got bigger?
Well, we're also short. I figured we needed a little bit more body mass. we were rocking as the trio, like, and that, you know, that was something we did. But I always wanted to have, you know, a few more textures to be able to, you know, to play off of, and it's also more fun having, you know, having more people. The more the merrier, you know.
Well, before we talked, I was listening again to some of the songs from the first album, Not Yet Now, and then listening to your new one, Wishbones, and it seems like you've really expanded the musical horizons of the band. Was that deliberate?
Oh, yes. I think I may have wanted to go for something like that for as long as I can remember, but just maybe wasn't able to write the songs to be that way or to have the ability to, with, you know, my friends and us, and like to be able to play it like that. But as we've grown up and matured and I guess, you know, honed our skills a little bit more, it's becomes more of a thing that we, you know, we can do. We could say, you know what, we can play it this complicated. No, you know, we could say, yeah, we can add parts to this, and we can think about, you know, it's like the more you play, just the more you can think about it in a way that's not so much just like, okay, what are the chords and what am I playing? You're just thinking more about these textures and what's the story's about, and what, you know, when you get better at it, you don't have to think so much about what you're actually doing with your instrument, and you could think just more about what your instrument is saying.
And it's the same producer on this record as the first one, and he's gained a few skills over the years too, a certain
exactly.
Jackie Green.
Yes,
your brother.
He's become even better of a producer, and yes, and also furthermore that he has become more, I guess he's heard more of what I've been doing as I've been growing up, so he has a better idea of what I'm trying to go for as well. So,
the album Wishbones is just out. Alex Nelson is the singer, songwriter, and guitarist in Walking Spanish. Alex, who are the other band members and what are they playing?
Oh, let's see. We've got, to my left here, you can't see, but this is Chris Hazlett playing the keyboards right here. On the album, he plays the organ, he plays the accordion, he plays the piano, anything with ivory and ebony on it. And, let's see, we've got the Peaky Brothers. This is Timmy Peaky playing the bass guitar and Patrick Peaky playing the drums. They're just rock solid, so.
Yeah.
And you know, it's all reflective of their personalities as well.
And then there's an unusual instrument for a rock band.
Unusual instrument, but he's bringing something new to the table, because you don't hear many violin players who play through an electric guitar amp. This is Mr. Tom Gunterman playing this solid body electric violin.
Great. Well, thanks very much. It's a really good record, and good luck with it.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Alex Nelson, Walking Spanish, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Walking Spanish is one of five bands on the bill for this year's Shannapalooza Music Festival. It happens this Saturday afternoon and evening at Swabies on the River, which is on Garden Highway near Interstate 5. And that's Insight for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, and Christine Guerra. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The engineer today, though, is Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
Good to be here in the culture bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
It's kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.